Orson Welles, usually heard at this time, is ill today. Instead, you will hear Don Hollenbeck, reporter, war correspondent, and ABC News commentator, Mr. Hollenbeck.
Being called in on short notice to understudy for Orson Welles, one has the feeling of a mixed personality. A man from Mars, Dr. Faustus Brutus, Macbeth, the shoemaker on holiday, Citizen Kane, or double-dealing Dick around the world. As a garden variety of news commentator, one gets a severe attack of stage fright, but one stumbles on stage and reads one's lines. And the first scene opens in the Capitol. In the words of Brutus's Portia, "I heard a bustling rumor like a fray, and the wind brings it from the Capitol." This afternoon, it brings an extremely confused and confusing story. The House and Senate compromise on OPA, which has finally been reached. As it stands now, the conferees have agreed to a 1 year's extension of price and rent controls, although ceilings will not go back on foods for a month, perhaps not even then. The compromise legislation provides for a 3-member decontrol board, which could determine whether to lift controls on individual items after controls are restored on August 20th. What it amounts to is this 3-member decontrol board will be empowered to overrule OPA. In fact, OPA won't amount to much except for its authority over rents. The legislation now goes back to the Senate and House for their approval, then to the White House. Although President Truman doesn't like the bill, it seems to be about all he's going to be able to squeeze out of Congress, and he's expected to sign the measure with reluctance. We've had 3 weeks now of a free market with the lapse of OPA, and we've had an opportunity to see what can happen to prices and supplies without controls. The compromise provides a complex formula for designing controls for various food items. Among those on which the lid goes back automatically on the 20th of August are meats, dairy products, grains, cottonseed, soybeans, and feed products. But the decontrol board could decide before that time against restoring any or all of those items to price controls, or it could decide at some time after the controls have been restored to remove the lid from any or all of the items. As one can see, this decontrol board is going to be an important group in the nation's economy for some time to come. The compromise legislation provides that no more than 2 of its 3 members can be from the same political party. But the most authority is given the Secretary of Agriculture. He has the say-so about certifying each commodity in short supply over which ceilings can be maintained. The law says that by the end of the year, the Secretary shall recommend the removal of price ceilings from items not considered important to living costs. Whoever the OPA administrator is to be, he's directed to follow the recommendation of the Secretary of Agriculture on price adjustments or ceiling removals. And though the compromise legislation directs that prices are to be rolled back, it doesn't say how far. Presumably, the OPA administrator or the decontrol board will decide if they ought to go back as they were on June 30th when OPA went into limbo. In the meantime, during those 3 weeks, there's been a flood of goods from agricultural areas to the market. Never so much meat in a long time, never at such prices. At Chicago, beef on the hoof hit the all-time high point of $26.35 a hundred compared to $21.50 in 1919. At Omaha, cattle and hog trucks lined up for 4 miles to the slaughter pens. Many animals died of the heat. But the big meat rush was on, the hurry up to share in the bonanza of high prices while the getting was good. At a few points around the country, consumers objected so strenuously to paying increased prices that they had to come down some. But that wasn't the general story. Average prices tell that. And at the end of this week, most steers were bringing $19 to $23 and a half. At the week ending June 29th, the average cost was $17.45. Anyhow, it's now up to Congress again to accept or reject or modify further this puzzling product of its conference committee. Administration leaders fervently hope that both the House and Senate will approve the measure and send it along to the White House for an unwilling okay by the President. But it's by no means a foregone conclusion that the battle of OPA is over even yet. The Senate is especially sensitive to agricultural pressure, and its members may be expected to show a lot more tenderness on that subject than will the House, whose membership represents more urban interests, more consumer interests. And these have been filling the air with protest at the rising cost of living. And, of course, there's always the bust to look forward to after the boom. Even if the boom goes under the lid right now, there's going to be a bust even of minor proportions. Somebody's going to have to get stuck for the high prices now prevailing in wholesale markets. And while the dear old consumer is the logical goat, some wholesalers and retailers are going to get caught as well. However, price ceilings are restored, they'll have no effect on products which have been purchased at higher prices during our 3-week spree, the gap in price controls. Purchased by wholesalers and retailers, that is. They're likely to find themselves holding a lot of goods and commodities for resale to the public and at prices which the public refuses to pay. Speculators who'd hoped to make a killing will be holding the bag, and some legitimate dealers who were drawn into the buying spree will find it somewhat costly, too. In the confusion as it exists now, officials are undecided what can be done for legitimate dealers who paid higher prices because of the end of subsidy payments by the government. Well, thus the bustling rumor, like a fray which comes and with the wind from the capital. And to go around the world, one recalls the opening of Act One, Scene Two in Macbeth, Duncan's words. What bloody man is that? He can report, as seemeth by his plight, of the revolt, the new estate. And the scene shifts to Bolivia, where there have been plenty of bloody men. Although censorship has been rigid, reports have been coming out telling of a serious revolt there, finally crushed after more than 100 deaths. Demonstrations have been held in La Paz against the dictatorship of President Villarreal, but according to reports reaching Buenos Aires, the government has won the upper hand now, although there are still stories of fighting going on. Reports from La Paz trickling through the censorship say that all business in the Bolivian capital remains paralyzed by a general strike, and that public indignation is extreme because police had fired on a crowd of civilian demonstrators during the disturbances. Our American Broadcasting Company correspondent in Buenos Aires sends along the information that President Villarreal has attempted to increase his iron grip on Bolivia by naming a cabinet made up entirely of military men, and that the key post, the Minister of War and Defense, has been given to a character named Lieutenant General Angel Rodriguez, whose career has some features of interest. According to our correspondent, General Rodriguez is identified by the American State Department Blue Book on Nazi activity in South America as a fascist and a pro-Nazi militarist. As Minister of War and Defense, the general is now the most powerful man in Bolivia. During the trouble 3 years ago in which Villarreal became president, Rodriguez's reputation as a Bolivian Nazi was so notorious that even his fellow conspirators couldn't stomach him as president. Well, it seems he didn't need the job after all. In his present one, he has more authority than the president himself to run Bolivia. The tyrant has shown his face. But that is rather old-fashioned tyranny. Our Congress has just acted to perpetuate military tyranny in its more modern form, in the control of atomic energy. The House of Representatives has taken action on the Atomic Control Bill, which now goes to a conference committee for the adjustment of differences between the Senate and House versions. It's a long way from the shape in which President Truman endorsed it after unanimous passage by the Senate early last month. And in its present form, it's heavily bound with brass. The major differences are over the voice the military shall have in control of atomic energy development and the stiffness of penalties for violations. The Senate's measure proposes a 5-member civilian control commission. The House says at least one, not more than 2 members of this commission be from the armed forces. The Senate provided for a civilian director of the military application division. The House insists the director be a member of the armed forces. The Senate approved top penalties of 20 years imprisonment, a $20,000 fine for the giving away of atomic secrets. The House voted the death penalty for major offenses deliberately committed, intended to aid another nation to the detriment of the United States. But it's in the interpretation of the part the military shall play in the control of nuclear development that the two versions differ most. As passed by the House, the military could exert a powerful part in influencing the exact actions of the commission. What it amounts to is that in this latest achievement of science, we would practically be under military rule. We seem unwilling yet to take the lead in world control of atomic energy. This view is expressed by Representative Short, the Missouri Republican. He's been opposed to any legislation at all until, as he says, world conditions are more settled. As if world conditions could ever be settled in the air of indecision, suspicion, and bad will that seems more and more to prevail in world relations. We demand evidences of goodwill from Russia on our terms, without opening the hand we hold behind our backs. The Russians, of course, suspect our motives, continue to operate unilaterally, and the British do the same, and the feeling of nationalism spreads. It all reminds me very much of the story of the great Congress of the Ostriches. At some time or other before the atomic age, the ostriches of the world, communicating with each other however ostriches do, decided they must elect a queen. The ostrich is the largest living bird. To be queen of the ostriches, one can realize, is an extremely high honor, and one can imagine the fever of anticipation which spread throughout the ostrich world at the news of the coming event. The genus Struthio, with its 2 toes, shared in the preparations with Rhea, the South American ostrich, which has 3 toes, or maybe it's the other way around. And all over the world, wherever ostriches live, they made preparations for this great event of electing a queen. From the sandy plains and open country of Arabia and Africa, little groups got together for the preliminary balloting. These groups, or troops as they're called, come in sets of five or six ostriches, one gentleman to five ladies, and a good many eggs were allowed to go bad. The gentlemen ostriches were supposed to watch over them by night, but the political discussions were so feverish that they often stayed out very late in the Kasbah or at Shepherd's in Cairo, haggling about the matter. Normally, the ostrich has great solicitude for its young, almost as much as it has for its elegant plumage. But a considerable number of complaints of neglect were heard during the preliminary balloting for the queen. But at last it was done. The queen was named. A gorgeous creature, 8 feet high, weighing 300 pounds, without a keel on her breastbone, as a true ostrich should be, and of elegant plumage. She lived in South Africa, and in order to pay her the highest possible honor, the ostriches of the world decided to hold their congress in the Libyan desert. It seemed to be about as centrally located as any place they could decide on, convenient to the ostriches which lived along the French Riviera, the one or two which would have to come from the Regent's Park Zoo in London, or the Moscow Zoo. A rather longer trip for the ostriches of the United States. But they agreed that since few of them had traveled much, it would be fitting for them to make the trip to the old country. So from all over the world came the ostriches to the hot sands of Libya. They saw the sights of Tripoli and Algiers, but they didn't linger long there, heading to the hotter regions around the Tropic of Cancer. How many thousands there were, it's impossible to say. Even though one ostrich can distinguish another ostrich, I understand, I can't. And it became extremely confused because the ostriches were very convivial. They spent a great deal of time running around the sands, getting acquainted, making preparations for this great reception of their highly honored queen. She was to make a grand entrance on about the third or fourth day of the Congress. Just how to greet her, of course, was the big question. Some very special honor had to be paid Queen Two Toes, for that was her name. She was a Rhea, or maybe a Struthio. Just an ordinary banquet with everybody getting tight and listening to a lot of speeches wouldn't do, it was felt. The entertainment committee worked long and hard on the problem, and finally it achieved what it felt was perhaps a unique form of greeting. It was a plan which appealed to the whole ostrich world. The queen was coming up from South Africa on foot. It had been a point of pride with her that to be known as Queen Two Toes, she should show the ostrich world a burst of speed, and her retainers followed behind at a respectful distance. Well, the reception committee decided to greet her this way. At the moment of her arrival at the Tropic of Cancer in the Libyan desert, every one of those countless thousands of Rhea's and Struthios planned to hide. They were going to give her a reception like no other queen ever got in this world. And so it was. As Queen Two Toes came lolloping up over a sand dune at the Tropic of Cancer in the Libyan desert, every one of those thousands of ostriches had concealed himself and herself, heads down, well deep in the sand of the desert, plumes waving in the breeze. It was a miraculous sight. At the crest of the sand dune, the ostrich queen stopped and surveyed the prospect. She hadn't known quite what to look forward to, but certainly it wasn't a reception like this. She'd dreamed of all sorts of fancy preparations with ostrich plumes and so forth, but this one had her stopped, and it confused her considerably. So she stood there on the crest of the dune after that long trip from South Africa, the thousands of ostrich plumes waving in the breeze, every elegant neck well buried to a depth of a foot or more in the hot sands. She stood and looked, puzzled. Then she turned around and finally, as her retinue came puffing up behind, she turned to her courtiers and, in a voice of wonder, she said, "Where in the world is everybody?" And being ostriches, of course, they couldn't tell her.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard news commentator Don Hollenbeck substituting this afternoon for Orson Welles, who is ill. The American Broadcasting Company hopes that Mr. Welles will be back again with us at the same time next Sunday. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.